Hello and welcome to Holded Village. Today is July 26, 2006, and today's session is entitled Conscious Consuming, presented by John DeGraff, number DEJ-2006-03. Let's listen in.
And thanks for all of you being here again today. I haven't scared too many away, I guess, so far. So it's always great to be here. I know many of you have been to my talks before, but for those of you who haven't, I'm John DeGraff, and I make films as a profession with the public TV station in Seattle, and I'm also something of an activist gadfly, and things as well. I get very involved. Often get very involved with the issues that I make films about, which I guess you're not supposed to do, but that seems to be what happens in my case. I can't remain sort of value-free about those things, so I do get involved. What I'm not going to do today is be very political at all. I think I maybe did enough of that the last 2 days, and so today we're not going to talk about laws or government rules or things like that at all. I'm sorry, I'll try to be louder. Okay, maybe we should, I don't know, close the door or something. Oh yeah, okay. So today we're going to talk about voluntary things, about things, ways in which we can actually use the market and we can actually express our preferences in the market for a better world through the whole idea of product certification and product labeling, and also through just kind of thinking about when we consume, how we consume, and what it is that we want to do. How many people here have made some kind of conscious effort in a way to sort of simplify your lives economically, to kind of pull back a little bit? Quite a number. How many are thinking about anything like that, kind of moving back a little bit in how much you consume and so forth? Of those of you who have done that, I'd love it if anybody would speak up and say, you know, kind of a little bit about what you did and what it's meant for you, how well it's worked. Anybody want to address that? The folks who, yes.
Well, my husband and I live in Tucson, and it's only a matter of time before the water table continues to keep dropping to the point of no return kind of thing. And we put a 5-gallon plastic tub in our shower, which fills up between the two showers very easily, which we feed to the cacti and stuff in the yard. And we put in a little gizmo that gives instant hot water, so you don't waste the water while it's getting warm. And we have a big pitcher in the kitchen that we pour our extra water from, water glasses that we feed the plants. So our water conservation has become a real big thing for us.
Important thing in Tucson. Important thing in many places, but especially, one of the. I'm going to show you a little piece first. Do a little more film stuff this morning. I'm going to show you first a little piece about just a couple who decided to try in a way to reduce their ecological footprint. We talked about that a little bit on Monday. That and your ecological footprint, as the idea goes, is. It was a thing that a couple of scientists who were at the University of British Columbia came up with some years ago. And they tried to figure out how many acres of land it takes to produce an average lifestyle and contrast that with how many acres of land are physically available if you were to divide them in an equitable sense among people around the earth. And what they figured was the number of acres that it takes to produce your lifestyle is what is called your ecological footprint. And I mentioned before, for those of you who are here, that you can find out what yours is, and it's kind of fun. It's certainly far from being exact, and people will have many complaints often. But if you go to a little website, when you get back to where you have web connection, if you go to a little website, just call www.myfootprint.org. I can't. I think it was pointed out at Vespers a couple nights ago that I can't read write in a way that anyone can read. We were the family that was embarrassed twice because we didn't get back from the hike. Or we got back and didn't sign out at the hike house.
Oh, no.
To double the embarrassment, they couldn't read my handwriting anyway. So, but anyway, what that says is myfootprint.org. And if you go there, you can take a test. It really takes less than 5 minutes to do it. And it asks you about things that relate to things like your housing, your mobility, the goods and services that you use, all kinds of things. In the end, it tells you what your footprint is. And most people who do it are somewhat in for a shock. I know I was. One thing that I found out was that what really adds to my footprint, and I'm pretty good about living fairly simply. We're not big consumers, and we live in a small place and actually walk to work, things like that. But what killed it for me was jet travel.
Yeah.
I'm often, I've kind of gotten off the hook because I know the fellow who invented the ecological footprint concept, and he sort of said, well, you know, if the travel is work associated to sort of spread the word about then. So this was sort of to remove some of the guilt. So my footprint, I found out, was that if I didn't fly so much, my footprint would be about equal to an average European, and still about 2.5 times what the Earth has in terms of if we were to share it equally right now, given current levels of consumption and technology. But it's my footprint is still somewhat less than the average American. I'm just going to show you a little clip that explains this concept and also talks about one Seattle family that decided to change their footprint. And what they did, and some things they did that were relatively simple. Let's hope that the...
There is no doubt about it. America has big shoes to fill. How big? 10? 12? How about 24? Acres, that is. 24 football fields, sideline to sideline, end zone to end zone. That's the size of the average American's footprint. By now, you're probably wondering, is this guy nuts? Who wears a size 24 acres? Well, welcome to Ecological Footprint 101, a system that measures the number of acres it takes to produce your lifestyle, your food, your clothes, your shelter, your mobility, your entertainment, and everything else. Plus, there's the cleanup.
How much area is necessary to support me, or to support our cities, to support our economies, to support the world as a whole, all humanity, to maintain all the resources we consume and to absorb the waste? That's what the ecological footprint measures.
Several years ago at the University of British Columbia, Matisse Wackernagel began to calculate what it really requires to provide for our lives. He wanted to know how much biologically productive land and water were needed per person in every country. He wondered if the way we were living was sustainable over the long run. Turns out it takes 24 acres or more to provide for the average American, a little less for Canadians, and about half as much for Europeans. That's bad news all around. Because there are less than 5 acres available for each person on Earth.
That needs to support everything we do. All the food we eat, all the resources that we consume, absorb all the waste. If everybody lived like the U.S. average lifestyle, then it would take about 5 planets.
So we're 4 planets short, and that's just for humans.
We may choose not to use everything for ourselves, because some may remember we're not the only species on this planet. The fish I eat is not available to the seal or to the whale. Today, we're using 20% more than what nature can regenerate. In other words, it would take a year and more than 2 months to regenerate everything that we use within 1 year. It's like if I start to spend more money than I earn. You know, it works for some time, but has consequences.
There is, however, some good news. It is possible to reduce our footprint and lessen our impact on the Earth. Just ask this American couple. Not long ago, Nora Daly Pang heard a lecture about ecological footprints.
I was inspired to calculate our footprint, and actually was so inspired I sent it to everyone in my office. How many miles per gallon does your car get? So I have a Volkswagen, and I'm in the 25 to 35 miles per gallon.
Nora and her husband, Tien, took a simple test to measure their own footprints.
10 to 100?
Yeah, that'll be fair.
Yeah.
Their ecological footprints measured at about 21 acres each, nearly the American average.
I think we were surprised because we're both environmentally conscious, and to come up with a 21-acre ecological footprint was surprising. We thought we were doing much better than the national average.
At the time, they lived in this modest suburban home.
Because it's an old home, it was uninsulated, and it was a big heat loss and energy drain. We would have to mow our lawn all the time, and I cannot stand that. Well, actually, I think our neighbors thought that we should mow the lawn more frequently.
The neighborhood is kind of typical suburbia, a lot of single family homes, no sidewalks. The destination is the gas station on the on-ramp to 405. We spent a lot of time in Seattle for evening events.
It wasn't easy for us to take the bus. Wherever we had to go, we had to commute by car to get downtown Seattle, get to work.
Shortly after they took the footprint test, Tien and Nora moved into an urban townhouse on Seattle's Beacon Hill. They pay more than they did for their suburban home, but are actually saving money in other ways. Drought-tolerant plants have taken the place of the lawn they used to mow, and they water those plants from a barrel that collects rain off the roof.
This home is part of the Built Green building program.
Designed to be environmentally friendly, their new home is better insulated and much more energy efficient. But it's not just the home.
We have all Energy Star appliances. Our refrigerator and washer dryer are Energy Star rated.
And dishwasher.
We have hardly any storage space, so it's really forced us to purge a lot.
Yeah. All right.
There are stores, a library, and cafes only blocks from their new home.
Thanks.
That means they can often walk or bike to get what they need, weather permitting, of course. Otherwise, a bus stop with frequent services nearby.
It's a 5-minute walk to the bus stop, and that's really handy for myself. I work downtown.
Each of these changes reduces their footprint. They also become part of the community-supported agriculture movement.
Hi, honey.
Hi, Nora.
Every few days in season, they receive a box of vegetables from a local farm.
Get some carrots.
That reduces their food footprint.
I don't know what this is, actually.
Mustard green.
Oh.
It does force you to learn new recipes, like cooking with kohlrabi and fennel. And
welcome.
Hello, neighbors. How are you? How's it going?
The other nice thing is that it's supporting a local small farm, and it's organic produce, so it's healthy for you.
One of the things they like best about their new lifestyle is a feeling of community they didn't experience in the suburbs.
We've made new friends. Our neighbors have become our friends.
Tian and Nora feel much better about their ecological footprint now. They've reduced it by nearly half to 12 acres, about the average in Europe. They plan to find ways to cut it even further, and they hope other Americans will follow their example.
I don't think we're extreme in any sense.
Cheers to the neighbors.
Being environmentally friendly or sustainable doesn't need to be extraordinary. I don't think it was much of a sacrifice. I think a lot of Americans just don't know that there other choices exist.
I think it's been a real evolution for me. It's not a huge effort. We get to live our lives to the fullest.
Something you might want to do is check that out and get a sense of it, and don't be hard on yourself or anything, but think, you know, are there some ways that we can reduce this? And you know, obviously not everybody can move or do anything like that. You can make changes where you are. They yeah, John.
Pull the screen up. So the microphone comes down, because otherwise you won't be recorded.
Oh, okay. Oh. All right.
It's behind your head.
Behind the microphone. Okay. Oh, yes. Oh. See, he's an economist. He knows that. Not me. I just make TV things. So. I never know anything about tech. I don't know anything about technology. I'm a technological idiot. You know, the people I work with who do the technological part are always amazed at how little I know when it comes to that. But they do the work. One other thing I would suggest that I think a lot of you might find interesting, especially relationship to family and to kids, in terms of teaching kids different habits of consumption and being conscious about that, and because you know our society is definitely targets kids. I think we all see how kids have been sort of targeted by media as to be sold to things, and it's easy for kids to get caught up in that, and it's often tough for parents to deal with it. I have a good friend. Some of you may know him. I'm hoping that he'll be at Holden next year. We've been talking with Paul about that. His name is Nathan Dungan. And he's at, in Minneapolis. And he runs a program called Share, Save, Spend. And you can actually find that at sharesavespend.com. He worked for 12 years for Lutheran Brotherhood. His dad is a Lutheran pastor. And his background is in financial things. But he really went into the whole idea of how to help kids learn to use money wisely and not to waste and not to get trapped into sort of an extreme material lifestyle. And his concepts are wonderful because they sort of start, I think they come out of his Christian principles, and they start with the idea of sharing. You know, they're teaching the kids that whatever you have, a lot of the joy comes from what you give to others and the sense of community that's created by that. And then secondly, about, you know, how to save. And then finally, when you do spend, how to spend responsibly and in a way that contributes in a positive sense, rather than both to your happiness and to your lifestyle, but also to other people. And I think one of the really exciting things that is going on in the country today, and in fact around the world, is the product certification movement. What's the first example that many of you saw of certified products?
Energy Star.
You saw Energy Star stuff, okay, but even before
coffee.
Pardon?
Fair Trade Coffee.
Fair Trade Coffee. We're going to talk about that a little bit. What was first that people started getting a lot of...
Housekeeping and stuff.
Pardon?
Good housekeeping approval.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Way back. Good housekeeping.
Organic.
Organic. I think the whole idea of organic food and organic labeling and a certification and stuff is something that people have become very acquainted with. Yes?
In Wisconsin, we have garbage, Jewish, free.
Can you hang on 1 second until the bus makes its pass here? That's the bovine growth hormone free. Yeah, it's a kind of a people who don't want genetically engineered products and so forth. There are labels for that as well. And the idea of product certification gives us the chance, I think, to vote with our dollars in a real sense in the marketplace for products that at least we can believe have some positive impact in terms of both social justice, and that people may be receiving a fairer price for what it is they produce, in terms of the environment, sustainability, all of those kinds of things. And of course, you have to be a little careful, because it's not always true that everything meets what it says. But that's why we, in certification, the certification systems that I think we need to pay most attention to are the ones that have what we call third-party certifiers, somebody who's outside. It's not just a company saying we're green and putting a green label on the product, but that there's a third party not associated with the company that actually checks it out to make sure that it's working. So I'm going to show you now just a little bit of a film that I will show tonight for those of you who have the time and want to see the whole film. This is a new one that just came out in January. I'm going to ask you, because your local PBS station will be getting this film basically by satellite on August the 20th, and hopefully we'll schedule it sometime in October, which is Fair Trade Month. So I am going to ask you, if you like this film, if you see part of it or you see all of it and like it, to, when you go back home, to contact your local public TV station and tell the programmer to put it on, because that's one of the things that they really do pay attention to their audience and what the audience wants. I will also just pass out some booklets and drop them back. I don't have enough, unfortunately, for everybody, but just so people can have a look, it just gives you a sense of what the film overall is about. And I'm going to show you a little of the beginning of that film. Oh, yeah. Now I've got to pull it back down. Okay.
Buyer Be Fair, the promise of product certification, was made possible by funding from the Ford Foundation.
There's no doubt about it. World trade is bringing all of us closer together. Never have so many products from so many places competed for our attention. So much wealth, so much choice, and yet... As globalization's critics remind us, half the world's people remain desperately poor. Their misery and our insatiable passion for resources threaten land, air, forests, water, and even life itself. But what if our purchases could actually improve things? What if we could shop with a conscience? Might something as simple as a label on a product help change the legacy we leave for generations to come?
I believe consumers in the United States and in Europe are a sleeping giant. They have tremendous power to affect change. through their purchasing decisions. So if we can awaken the sleeping giant, we can transform society. We can truly transform the market.
In southern Mexico is a land of contrast, with its bustling capital city, colorful celebrations, rugged relief, stunning seascapes, dense forests, supporting one of the world's most diverse songbird populations. Yet Oaxaca is a place where poverty is always nearby. Here, where temperate zone and tropics merge, lies a land once isolated. Now tightly connected to each twist of the global economy. This is a place where new ideas are emerging. The coffee sure looks appealing. At Cafe Antigua in Oaxaca City, owner Diego Woolrich spends 60 hours a week serving his customers while wishing he was somewhere else. Back where his delicious Arabica beans were grown. Woolrich owns a coffee plantation hours away in the mountains.
Los bajos precios del café a nivel mundial.
The low prices on the world market make it impossible to survive just by producing coffee.
It often costs Diego Woolrich more to cultivate his beans than he can sell them for. If he didn't own this coffee house, he would have to abandon his plantation. Then soon, it would look like this. Not long ago, hundreds of people made a living here. Alemania Plantation was once a whole town unto itself, with its own city hall and brightly painted church. Now, Alemania is deserted, its workers scattered to the winds. Even the dishes were left unwashed. Up the road is another plantation, likewise abandoned. The grand patios, once covered by coffee beans, are empty now. Neither place could compete with the cheap beans that flooded the market when two countries, Brazil and Vietnam, dramatically increased their coffee production.
The coffee coming out of Brazil and Vietnam tends to be fairly low quality, so it's going into canned coffees. But those coffees have created an oversupply situation globally, which has led to plummeting coffee prices for all growers.
Not only plantations are in trouble,
most coffee farmers are very small growers, family farmers, that grow coffee on 1, 2, 3 acres of land.
And they've never had it easy. Poor and isolated, they sell their beans to middlemen, coyotes they call them, who earn a lion's share of the profits.
Now add on that the current coffee crisis, and what you have is a truly dramatic and chilling tale of human suffering.
So what do coffee farmers do? Either they abandon the land and go somewhere else looking for a job, Mexico City or even the United States, or they start clearing, cutting down the shade coffee forest to grow maize, beans for subsistence, cattle, you name it.
As she studies these developments, Mexican ecologist Beatrice Avalos grows increasingly worried.
If things continue as they are, then what we will see happening is the total destruction of this forest with irreversible damages to biodiversity, to the soil, tremendous erosion. The aquifers will all dry up, so we will have a big water problem.
More than land and water are at stake.
The people suddenly are left with nothing, and therefore nothing to lose. The immediate consequences of that may be very radical in terms of social and political instability. And we know what can happen with social and political instability.
It's a troubling scenario. At less than an hour by dirt road from the abandoned plantations, the news is quite different. For the first time ever, the tiny outpost of Shaniga has a store. There's a new grinder for making cornmeal. The coffee farmer Jose Vasquez, his wife Catalina, and their seven children, life is actually looking brighter. They are still poor, but earning much more now, thanks to a program called Fair Trade. Each morning, Jose loads his burro for the trek to a steep ridge where his coffee trees grow. With other scattered villagers of Shaniga, Jose belongs to a cooperative called La Trinidad. Like many similar cooperatives around the world, La Trinidad sells much of its coffee for premium fair trade prices that are higher than those offered on the world market. Sometimes the fair trade price is double the world market price, and because most of La Trinidad's coffee is organic, it brings an additional premium of several cents a pound.
Me ha dado cuenta que comer si justo para mí es este...
Fair trade has done a lot for me and my family. We're better off. Before, I didn't even have a drying patio. We were selling cheaply, and now we're getting a better price. It's changed the whole community a lot. I say thank you to those in the United States who buy the coffee from us, because this helps us succeed.
Sure, we have the microphone here. And that, look at that, magic. You learn something every day.
Is that Scott Simon?
Yes, it's Scott Simon. Yeah, I use Scott. How many of you are familiar with Scott Simon? He's the Saturday morning host on National Public Radio and a good friend of mine, and so I use him a lot as a narrator for different films, because he has a great voice and he very much cares about these issues and is very interested in them and so forth. So it's been a good partnership. I actually started doing things with Scott back in 1991, so it's been about 15 years now that we've been working together on those things. So anyway, how many of you, fair trade, what the film will do from this point on is it kind of goes into, it looks a little more at these cooperatives, this town and other towns, and how fair trade is changing life for people there and in a positive sense, and how the folks cooperate to use the new money that comes in for fair trade to do more than just give it additional funds to each coffee producer, but in fact to build things in the community, everything from health clinics to other kinds of things that help people out. And we go from there into a little bit of the history of fair trade and find out actually how fair trade actually began in the Netherlands, the whole idea of fair trade, and has since spread to many, many countries and is actually most popular and most successful in the United Kingdom, in fact, today. the Brits are very, very conscious about consuming and about certified products generally. They're the number one consumers of per capita of fair trade products. They're also the number one consumers of the other item that we talk about, that we use as a case study in this film, and that is Forest Stewardship Council certified timber. So we look at how certified timber is changing forestry management practices in a way that's more sustainable. We sort of look at fair trade as an example of the social justice side of the equation, improving the livelihood of people, and then the forest stewardship certification as an example more of improving the environmental situation, although there's a considerable amount of crossover. And so that's kind of what the film does. I want to just ask you, I know that many, many churches have been involved with fair trade coffee and have really been doing it. Also, colleges around here in the Pacific Northwest, almost every university is now a fair trade university there. The students have done this. It's fair trade has been one of the big issues of activism on college campuses. In the Northwest, it started at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, and now many colleges have followed suit. There's something like a couple of hundred colleges now around the United States in which the food service serves fair trade coffee because the students have pushed them to do so. But have any of you been involved, or have your churches been involved in the fair trade coffee campaign? Oh, quite a few. Anyone want to talk about that? Good, I'm off. Yes, go ahead.
We don't actually buy the brand fair trade. Quite a few years ago, through Augsburg College, I went to Central America, and we have a sister parish there as well, and discovered a community in Guatemala, San Lucas Soliman, and the Catholic Church there for a number of decades has been establishing a situation where they resettle Mayan people, and they have a coffee cooperative among other cooperatives. The priest came from New Ulm, Minnesota, and so they process the coffee completely and then ship it back to New Ulm directly, and then we buy the coffee from the local parish in New Ulm. And the great thing about it is that the coffee, we know it's organic, and we know that they're continuing to add more people to this lifestyle. The interesting thing was that when we first started buying it, they were only charging $5 a pound, plus one extra ounce. And we challenged Father Schaefer when we were there, and he said, well, the problem is, and I think it's an interesting dilemma, and I think they're working at this, because he said if in resettling these people we give one group of people too much money right now, it's going to really change the balance within the local community. So they were working at that. Now we're paying $7 a pound, which is a much better price, I think, for it. But because of that, they've also built a hospital, a school, and they really established a really great community, as a result of that kind of agriculture. So
now you're paying $7. Who's getting $7?
The church in New Ulm isn't making a cent.
Uh-huh.
And
so you're actually buying coffee for $7.
We're buying it directly
for seven. Uh-huh.
Because
the fair.
$7.
Well, that sounds like a great program. Yeah, absolutely. Have others of you been in used products like Pura Vida or Equal Exchange or some of the other actually certified fair trade products? Anybody want to talk about that a little bit? What your church is doing?
Yeah, I was fortunate to go with this in Rwanda, Tanzania 2 years ago and visit coffee farmers on Mount Kilimanjaro, and where Equal Exchange is very much involved. And so when I came back, really, I was fired up about getting fair trade coffee going in our church. We sell it one Sunday a month. We now sell about $700 worth on that one Sunday a month.
Wow.
After the last 2 years. Equal Exchange is mentioned up there, but they're a remarkable organization, I think. Their CEOs are not allowed to earn more than three times their lowest pay.
It's kind of a cooperative, yeah. Equal Exchange is a co-op. And Equal Exchange, that company was the first in the U.S. to sell certified fair trade coffee back in 1986. There are now more than at last count, somewhere around 400 fair trade brands in the United States. But Equal Exchange was the first to do that, and they've done some wonderful things. But there are a lot of, in this area, some former Microsoft folks, used those stock options and some of the money that they made at Microsoft, and they started a company called Pura Vida, which many of the colleges and other groups use here. And all of that money, all the profits from that goes back to development projects, as particularly for children. So there's a lot of exciting things, both from the nonprofit like Pura Vida or even Equal Exchange, and then the for-profit companies, many of them also doing great things because of the fair trade money itself is doing great things. Yes, John?
I have to wash dishes, so I go with you, but I have to say the economist thing here.
Okay.
I think we want to be conscious about the language we use, because one implication from the film was that Brazil and Vietnam were somehow being unfair when they produced the same coffee at a lower cost. Right?
No, not that they're unfair. No.
Okay. I think we need to be conscious of the fact that the reason that the Mexican coffee growers were going out of business was because somebody had figured out a way to produce coffee at a lower cost. Okay? And it is unfortunate that they went out of business because somebody else had gotten more productive. Okay? But in fact, we don't want to say that's unfair. And we don't want by our language to imply that somebody who loses their job or their because somebody else does the thing they're doing better is somehow an unjust part of society. It's a problem, and it's something we as Christians need to be addressing, but it's not unfair.
Well, I don't want to use the term unfair about in terms of I would agree with you. What I would say though is that the coffee produced in Brazil and Vietnam was extremely it's sun-grown coffee by stripping large amounts of forest land and other things, produced in a much less sustainable way, and really in a way dumped on the market, and it's had a very very it's had a negative effect, whether we want to call
it. We're going to castigate as more than unfair.
Pardon?
We're going to castigate that as more than unfair.
I think using the word better is not a good word to use either. They're making more money, but they're not necessarily doing it in a better way.
They're more productive in a narrow sense that they can turn out coffee cheaper, but that's in some sense because these other kinds of costs are not figured in. That what the Mexican ecologist points out is that, you know, there is a cost to us of the loss of these aquifers and a cost to us, and if we actually somehow could put these into the market price, then,
I agree completely.
Okay.
Okay, but I also agree that if we, let's say we all bought fair coffee from Latin America, and Americans just stopped drinking coffee from Vietnam, and then we did this film in Vietnam.
If Vietnam was making it,
we have to think about as Christians the implications of all the dimensions of our response.
But are the people in Vietnam and Brazil making a fair wage by this lower cheap coffee, or are they barely existing so that we could buy cheap coffee?
Well, they do. They don't have coffee.
And are they also growing it so it sustains the earth?
As coffee consumers in the earth.
That's about us.
It is about us. I think it's all very much about us.
I think John's points are well taken, that we obviously have to consider all of these things in the decisions we make. I don't think at this point in time that's, the total of fair trade coffee is still a very small part of the coffee market, but it does make, your purchase of fair trade coffee can make a huge difference for many, many people. And I don't say never buy anything else. Yes?
It really could if we decided that we were only, that the Americans in a collective kind of way said, we're only going to buy fair trade coffee. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that would make an enormous difference in the market. And as we were talking about yesterday, you know, and by the way, I agree with everything, as John and I have been talking about, I agree with all the goals that John is talking about. Right? Is that what would happen if we said, if the government said we can only buy fair trade? If it was mandated, would that be a better thing?
No, we're talking about choices.
Yeah. But we do need to keep thinking about the implications.
not because I'm sorry you have to leave, because I have a little bit of a rebuttal, and that is that there's one kind of a paradigm that we look through, and it's pure economics and it's pure dollar. And I don't understand the complexity of economics, but when I hear the word fair is not accurately used, I'm thinking, well, maybe it is if we apply a different paradigm that says fair also includes, besides prices, a sustainable economy, a sustainable earth, and the kind of things that are happening in Vietnam, wherever they're doing it and dumping it. It's a whole different paradigm, I think, of how we see what is profitable.
Yeah, I think, but you're an English professor, right? Right. So you know that when we say something is fair in contrast to something else, the implication is that the other thing is unfair.
But because I'm an English professor, I think that maybe it is unfair when we look at that's a different sense of what fair and fairness is.
We could take that, John, I think, to say if we did some kind of full cost pricing and figured in the impacts of these things, we could maybe say that undercutting all that is unfair.
But you see, I don't see it that way. When we buy coffee from San Lucas, and I don't care if it's called fair or not. I know that it is fair for the people we buy from. And I can't buy coffee from everywhere. I don't drink it. But the point is it really reflects that exchange that happens between the consumer and the producer in my situation. That's all I do. And I know that it establishes a fair lifestyle for the Mayan people at San Lucas, totally mine. And I'm very conscious, and I think about how that affects the rest of the world. And I was going to ask this exact question at some point, because how do you balance those two? I think it's a terribly complicated situation.
I would agree. I also think, I mean, even within the fair trade world right now, and some of the things that is possible to talk more about, as John and I both said when we talked to you, we are oversimplifying. There's just no way with these complicated questions that we cannot. And there are arguments and discussions within the fair trade community. Do we certify plantations or just cooperate? Under what conditions? Is it a different kind of certification? How do we tell the consumer these things without making things so complicated that the consumer hasn't a clue and decides, I can't, you know. Remember, we're all pressed for time. So we, you know, as consumers, how much stuff can we read? And it's very difficult. And it is choice and it's balance. It's absolutely. But I think my personal experience was what I've seen is that fair trade and what churches and what people are doing, even in this small amount, has had a very positive impact in the lives of many, many people. Yeah.
Just my focus in the fair trade thing is how it introduces to a lot of people who haven't done so previously the idea of thinking about where the stuff they buy comes from and how it is made. And as the economy has globalized, it's been harder to know whether the people who made what you're using got a fair wage, or whether they were enslaved, whether they were little kids in West Africa growing the chocolate that I love. Mm-hmm. And so there's very difficult questions that we never got the information to even ask. And now we're having some of that information provided in one part through the fair trade movement. And to me, it's just integrated with the whole question of how much we consume and so forth. And so I'm glad to see that you're I don't know if it's the same film.
It is. As an education tool, I think it's a great thing as we learn about that. It also, I think, fits very much, and John isn't here to respond to this, but it actually fits in well with some of the basic ideas of neoclassical economics, which is that the market will work if people have full information. I mean, that's the part of Adam Smith that usually gets left out. That it's a small enough society where people really know and understand various kinds of things and have information about the products that they're buying, and therefore the invisible hand works because people are informed. But it's very tough in this huge thing to be informed, and one thing fair trade does is helps us know some of these things. Yes?
Well, I think even, you know, going with John, if you do consider the entire cost of mine tailings, you know, we've got copper wiring. Does that really cost us 20 cents a pound, or does it cost us cleanup as well? If you you've got the information, you can save corporations from their own stupidity. If the people in Vietnam are growing coffee and we stop buying that coffee, they'll probably go back to growing rice or something that they can eat. They can't eat coffee.
And when
the government would step in and have them grow something else that to be exported,
but,
rather than them growing self-sufficient.
Right.
Well, and you also have to understand that that in some cases, coffee is a very, very good crop to grow. I mean, we often think that because it's a cash crop, it's a negative. But believe me, from the ecologist's point of view, in these very steep-sloped areas and places in Central America, it is a whole heck of a lot better to grow coffee than to grow corn. The impacts on the environment from coffee are much, much less. Corn or in other cases beef and things like that, which is what some of this land is being used for. So there, it's a mixture. The problem, though, in many of the Vietnamese and Brazilian farms is that this is rolling land, not necessarily steep sloped. It's been the biological diversity has been basically taken away. The plants are grown in very neat. Rose in sun and harvested mechanically. And it's because they're grown like that you can harvest them mechanically, and of course that makes it a whole lot cheaper than when you have these people out there actually picking coffee beans. But it's rough on the environment, very rough on the environment. Yes?
I think it's interesting too, other teaching them to grow other crops that provide the shade, like bananas.
Oh, yeah.
Above the coffee bushes, and crops that grow between the coffee trees.
That's right.
Plus having huge research products as to fighting disease-resistant types of plants.
That's right.
They don't need the chemicals to protect.
No, that's right.
It's much cheaper.
And most of this coffee is organic. I mean, most fair trade coffee, about 85% of all fair trade coffee is organic. About 70% is also what we call shade grown. It has... it's grown in a situation of enough biological diversity that it's really, really preserving things. Paul, I think you had your hand up next.
Just a phrase that has helped me become conscious of this is from a video that the village has. It's called the high cost of low prices. When I heard
it's
that,
the Walmart,
phrase,
the Walmart film.
Yeah, it's about Walmart, but apply it to everything we buy, and what are we really paying when we get cheap gas, and we can look at the whole oil industry and all the supplements that the government gives, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's just a wonderful, for me, it works as a phrase to make me conscious of we're paying a lot more than we say we are, one way or another.
That's right, and that's what to consider. And if you're, if in your churches you can look at these questions, that one of the nice things about fair trade is, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but it awakens a whole conversation, helps people learn about the issues that are going on and stuff, and it's wonderful in that way for churches to do that and to connect with the community, find out where that coffee comes from and who those people are. Hang on. Yes, you had your hand up next, though.
I'm just wondering if your films can they be purchased only through PBS or how?
No, that my films are available through a company called Bullfrog Films. And if you go to their catalog, which is bullfrogfilms.com, they have sort of exorbitantly high prices on the films. But those are the prices that are charged to universities, which often have budgets that can handle that. Bullfrog Films also sells films at a much reduced rate for things like churches and things that... for most of the films, for example, if a church wants to buy a film and show it as much as they want, do anything they want with it, it's usually $59. So instead of $200 for the college. It's about twice as much as they charge for individuals who are just for home use. But it, oftentimes, it there'll be a few copies of, I've left a few copies of Buyer Be Fair for the silent auction. So some of you may be able to pick them up very cheaply if you want them. But of course, we encourage you to spend more and help hold the village with that. One of the fun stories, and something to think about back home too, that is in, one of the things that inspired me most in making the film is a little town in England. It's called Garstang, and you'll see the story about it in the film. It's a town of 5,000 people that had just a few citizens in their churches who actually decided to try to make their town the world's first fair trade town. And it has become that, and Garstang, with 5,000 people, got 90% of their businesses to carry, and not only carry, but advertise fair trade products and explain to people what they were about. Yes?
Where in England is that?
It's near Lancaster, in the northwestern part of England. It's quite an amazing thing to see all the because there are also places that carry fair trade products, but they do no education. They're just there, and people often don't have any idea what it means. There's an exception in the U.S., which we also look at in the film, is the supermarket chain called Wild Oats. Some of you may have. Wild Oats does a very good job not only of selling fair trade products and products like that, but of teaching people about what those products are. Yes?
In the criteria for getting a fair trade label or whatever, what kinds of things go into it? Are there a minimum percentage of the profit that needs to go to the farmers, or
there's a minimum.
Where do we see that kind of detail?
There is a fair amount of that in the film, but you can also find it. Particularly by going to the leading fair trade certifier in the United States. It's a wonderful organization. It's called Transfair USA. And you can go to transfairusa.org, transfair all one word, usa.org, and you can see some pretty good explanations of how this works. There also, I noticed up in the dining room there, as you come in, and the shelf that has some pamphlets, there are some Transfair pamphlets there, not very many, so you probably want to just look at them and leave them. But there are a whole number, too many for me to go into now, but criteria. And then now they've set up criteria for fair trade towns. And the movement has so captured the attention of people in the United Kingdom that there are now over 100 British cities and towns that are fair trade towns, in which the majority of businesses at least have really made this effort to carry fair trade products, to educate their customers about fair trade products. The city councils have endorsed fair trade, the churches, and people have come together around these ideas. And this is, you know, includes cities as big as Edinburgh and Cardiff in Wales, you know, now have gotten into this whole thing. And so England now is selling up to about, in products where there are fair trade alternatives, like coffee, the British are selling up to 15% in that, which is just shockingly higher than anyone else, and even much more than the Dutch, where this got started, because these British groups just took it on and really, really went with it. Yes?
This example of coffee, I think is fine. I don't know anything about chemicals. You mentioned organic grown, but I wonder how carefully that is monitored. Human beings being what they are, some people find they can manipulate their crop and their profit by soaking in what prevents them from doing that. But the other thing is, does fair trade or in the grocery store, products made in the United States have, the farmer has all kinds of regulations of what they must do and what they can't do and this sort of thing. And someone at higher levels of government is allowing produce to come in, the exact same produce that our farmers are regimented with, that there is no control at all, and that just doesn't seem fair to me.
Well, we certainly do get, you know, some produce, particularly from Mexico and other places, that that probably exceeds our standards on things like pesticides and things. No question about that. But fair trade, the fair trade and these certification systems are pretty strongly policed. And I mean, it's not perfect, and there is no way that's perfect. But I think it's pretty strongly policed, and sometimes people are caught cheating, and they lose their certification, and they lose a whole lot as a result. But the monitoring is quite regular, and of course the fair trade folks themselves have a reason to police each other, because they don't want their whole cooperative to be decertified. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Just in response to that, it's also true that due to so-called free trade like NAFTA, there are towns in Mexico that used to grow and sell their own potatoes that have been so flooded with subsidized potatoes from the United States that they can no longer sell their own locally grown potatoes.
Yes,
it happens both ways.
Yeah, corn is a big well. Yeah, even more with that. I think we should it is past time now. You're a wonderful group of folks, and I'm so honored and appreciative that there's enough interest to continue this, but it is past time, so thank you so much.